is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington, and here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You know, if you consider the economic situation that we're in as a country, we welcome investment. We welcome any initiative that's going to stimulate the economy and that's going to create real jobs.
That's Pakamile Hilubi Majola, spokesperson for the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, on Ford, saying it plans to invest more than $1 billion in the country, creating thousands of jobs. Details coming up. Also, there is a jump in coronavirus cases in South Sudan, and thousands of healthcare workers have registered to receive COVID-19 vaccines that have recently arrived in South Africa. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. President Joe Biden told U.S. State Department staff yesterday that America cannot afford to be absent on the world stage. Diplomacy, he said, is at the center of U.S. foreign policy, despite years of what he described as abuse and neglect by former President Donald Trump. Former U.S. Ambassador to Tunisia, Gordon Gray, recalls how U.S. foreign policy fostered the democratic transition in Tunisia under former President Barack Obama's administration. VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi has the details.
In a conversation with Project on Middle East Democracy in Washington, Gray said that under the Obama administration, the U.S. moved swiftly in response to the Tunisian revolution during the 2011 Arab Spring.
I think that the U.S., both the executive and the legislative branches, were quick to realize the magnitude and importance of what had happened in Tunisia, and were quick to offer both rhetorical support and some initial economic support.
Gray said both Democrats and Republican senators and members of Congress gave a standing ovation when Obama said in his State of the Union address that the American people stand with Tunisians and their aspiration for democracy. The former U.S. diplomat said the U.S. coupled its moral support with robust programs to facilitate Tunisia's democratic transition.
One of the milestones was President Obama's invitation to then Prime Minister Desikai Desepsi to visit the Oval Office on October 7th of 2011. That led to a number of agreements, more educational scholarships, sovereign loan guarantees to help boost the financial stability of the Tunisian government, money for the Overseas Private Investment Corporation for franchises in Tunisia, Peace Corps, things like that.
Gray praised Washington's short-term response as well as its longer-term commitment to help maintain security after the revolution. He said that despite Trump's attempts to cut U.S. assistance to Tunisia, strong bipartisan support has propelled Congress to reinstate it. Mohamed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
South Sudan has imposed a one-month partial lockdown after a jump in coronavirus cases. Africa's youngest nation has confirmed more than 4,000 cases and 65 deaths. But some residents worry this first lockdown since June could hurt people's livelihoods. Winnie Sirino reports from the capital, Juba.
South Sudan's National Task Force on COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, said Wednesday the partial lockdown was necessary after a surge in cases. Task Force member Dr. Richard Lacouz said virus cases have doubled in the past week.
In the last 7 days, we have recorded 218 confirmed cases compared to the week before. Which is the week of 20 to 26, we have 140 cases. But the week 27 to the 2nd of February, we have 218 cases, which shows almost doubling of the cases along the 2 weeks. And this shows that the positivity rate has been increasing from last week and to this week.
The chairman of the Officials Hassan Abdelbaji said the new lockdown measures affect all businesses and events that attract large crowds.
Ban all the social gatherings, such as sporting events, religious events, including Sunday prayers, Salat al-Jumma, mosque prayers, funerals, wedding ceremony, and political events. Two, closure of all free schools, universities, and all the other institutions of learning, except classes which are required for examination, observation of strict protective measures.
Abdelbaji said while bars and clubs will be closed, restaurants and tea shops are allowed to operate but must adhere to strict COVID-19 measures. Buses and taxis must reduce passenger numbers by half, he said, and enforce wearing face masks and social distancing. He added that all incoming passengers on international flights must have results showing they are free of the coronavirus. On the streets of Juba, there was mixed reaction to the restrictions. 35-year-old Godfrey Fred said he is worried the lockdown will affect people's incomes.
If you don't move, so survival itself will be very, very difficult. So at least we need our government to take another measure, not to close everything, because there are very many ways of preventing disease.
34-year-old Data Gordon has doubts the lockdown can be enforced.
I don't see this new lockdown being implemented because it's going to be a ground for corrupt practices like bribery for law enforcers who will definitely take and will get back to where we started.
57-year-old William Edward said the lockdown was a good idea to see spread, but said ordinary Sudanese would need government support.
Government have to provide things for the people to support them while they're in the lockdown period to help them. So as a society, we are suffering a lot. People are suffering. It's not easy to get food. They can break the lockdown because of the situation where they're facing.
South Sudan imposed its first lockdown in March last year, but lifted it in June after the level of reported COVID-19 cases dropped. Winnie Serino for VOA News, Juba.
Botswana's health minister says only citizens and legal residents will be eligible when the COVID-19 vaccine arrives, while thousands of undocumented immigrants will be left out. From Habrone, Botswana, reporter Mokandisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's Minister of Health, Dr. Edwin Dikoloti, says the vaccine will be available to citizens and documented migrants. The vaccination will exclude thousands of illegal immigrants, most who fled economic hardships in neighboring Zimbabwe.
In order to successfully reduce this transmission and contain the pandemic, it will be imperative to ensure that the entire population is vaccinated against the pandemic.
Dikoloti says the country has already paid $10 million to procure vaccines expected at the end of March. The minister says the vaccine will be available free of charge and aims to cover the entire eligible population.
As part of the broader strategy of fighting the COVID-19 pandemic, the government has embarked on an initiative to acquire and quickly deploy safe and secure vaccines for the citizens and residents of Botswana.
Botswana struggles with an influx of illegal immigrants, particularly from troubled Zimbabwe, and arrests and deports an average of 25,000 back to their native country every year. Most immediately find their way back, raising concerns they skip COVID-19 screening as they enter the country through unauthorized points. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Zimbabwe's cash-strapped government has been slow to secure COVID-19 vaccine, with some critics blaming poor handling of the outbreak and others citing lack of resources. Battered for years by corruption, drought, and weak fundamentals, the country's economy was in a tailspin before the pandemic, leaving it to struggle more than healthier economies. Reporter Kudza Zanawashi has more details.
Underscoring public unhappiness, the Minister of Finance on Wednesday sparked the fury after a state publication quoted him as saying some private citizens will have to pay for the vaccine so the government can recoup its procurement costs. The minister quickly backtracked yesterday with a brief statement from the ministry saying his comments had been taken out of context. Dr. Norman Matara is with the Zimbabwe Doctors for Human Rights. He says selling the vaccine is not such a bad thing under the right conditions.
I think as long as there is a provision for people who cannot afford to get the vaccine without paying, it's too okay for private practitioners to also chip in and sell to those who can afford. What we do not agree with is to have people who cannot afford having to be forced to get the vaccine on the commercial market.
In his State of the Nation address yesterday, President Emmerson Mnangagwa said the vaccine will be available for all at no cost.
As such, COVID-19 vaccines, which have been scientifically ascertained to be safe, will soon be introduced. These will be state-funded and free. The national vaccination strategy will continue to be guided by the best available scientific evidence, and the safety of all Zimbabweans remaining a priority.
The government has been in overdrive assuring the public that the vaccine will be free for all. Vice President and Health Minister Constantino Chiwenga is also on the list of officials who have later said the vaccine will be free. Mnangagwa said the plans to roll out are at an advanced stage.
A national vaccine deployment framework has also been finalized. The initial objective is to inoculate at least 60% of the population to achieve population immunity. The first phase of inoculation of the vaccine will see our hard-working frontline workers, the elderly, and those with underlying medical conditions being prioritized.
Government's backtracking on this issue has been linked to donor partners who are working to bring vaccine to Zimbabweans at no cost. Some critics say charging for the vaccine by the government would not be surprising. The government has struggled to provide protective gear in public hospitals. For VOA, this is Kudze Zinawashe from Harare.
Malawi has decided to keep schools closed for another 2 weeks amid a spike in COVID-19 cases. But education experts say the government could have found ways to get students back to the classroom. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
President Lazarus Chakwera ordered a 3-week school suspension in January as part of measures to contain the unprecedented rise in COVID-19 cases. The plan called for schools to reopen Monday, but Health Minister Khumbize Kandodo Chiponda announced last night during a televised COVID-19 update meeting that things have changed.
With the numbers and also the burden of the disease still being there, we have decided that schools should remain closed for another 2 weeks, and we'll do assessment again after 2 weeks to see if the burden has gone down so that our kids, they can go back to school.
Kandodo Chiponda, also a co-chairperson for the Presidential Task Force on COVID-19, says the country's test positivity rate of 20%, Malawi cannot risk reopening schools.
We do not want to send our kids to school when the burden is too high. My appeal to all parents, the danger is still there. Let's keep our children in our homes.
Public records showed that as of yesterday, Malawi had 25,884 confirmed cases of COVID-19, with 799 deaths and 10,265 recoveries. Benedicto Kondowe is the executive director of the Civil Society Education Coalition. He says there are alternatives that would allow learners to continue with their studies.
We know that the current cases seem to be prevalent in town.
Public records showed that as yesterday.
And we know that in town there are alternative sources of providing education, like access to internet. In the rural setting, what one was willing to hear is how are we going to reach out to them? So perhaps use of pamphlets for all the subjects, which would allow learners to have access to the materials during the time that the schools are closed.
Kondowe says keeping the schools closed compromises quality education because there is no indication when COVID-19 may end. Lameck Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
Thousands of healthcare workers have registered to receive some of the COVID-19 vaccines that arrived in South Africa a few days ago. The 1 million AstraZeneca shots were made by the Serum Institute of India. But as Darren Taylor reports, there are concerns that the government's online registration portal is vulnerable to hackers.
The government has established an electronic verification data system, or EVDS. It's not a security network, more like a way to capture the personal information of people who get vaccinated. Health Minister Zweli Mkhize says the EVDS is going to be crucial to ensuring an efficient vaccine rollout.
We would, however, encourage all healthcare workers to register before the inoculation call because this will help us to know how to refine our current allocations and get enough vaccines to the right vaccine centers at the right time.
International anti-crime organizations are warning, though, that organized criminal groups are hacking into EVDS systems to try to gain access to vaccine supplies. Once they get into the computer program, the criminals try to divert shipments to their collaborators. Mkhize says his cybersecurity team will prevent this, and his focus now is ensuring that every health sector employee in the country appears on the EVDS platform.
In the event that a healthcare worker has not self-registered, you will not be denied vaccination. You will be registered at the vaccination site. It must just take a few minutes longer.
Government immunization specialist Professor Leslie Bamford says it's not only doctors and nurses who'll get first access to jabs, but everyone in healthcare, from porters to hospital janitors and more.
Funeral workers, we are including traditional healers. So we have an extremely broad definition of people working in the health sector.
Some in the health sector are concerned, though, that the state isn't involving private corporations and civil society groups in the vaccine rollout. One of South Africa's most prominent aid organizations, the Gift of the Givers, has vast experience in participating in public health initiatives and disaster management around the world. Director Imtiaz Suleiman says he finds it amazing that a government which is clearly under pressure to deliver a good vaccination program hasn't called his organization for assistance.
The reality is they can't do it alone. They need partners. Companies called us and said, we have the biggest cold storage facility in South Africa. We can give that to you free of charge. We have cold storage trucks to carry the vaccines throughout the country. We can give that to you free of charge. Medical aids came and said, we have more than 4,000 nurses. We can use them to administer the vaccine. I got buy-in from companies to say, we can give you fridges with generators to help the hospitals.
But so far, says Suleiman, government hasn't responded to the offer of cooperation from Gift of the Givers. The state did, however, respond to a rumor that was circulating on social media about the aid group.
I got a as an international NGO, we can try to leverage companies to get vaccines as an NGO outside government to increase the number of ampules we can get faster to the country. There's no guarantee, but we can use our reputation.
The state says it plans to involve big business and civil society organizations in the vaccine rollout at what it calls an appropriate time. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa has welcomed the over $1 billion investment planned by the Ford Motor Company. Announced this week, it aims to create thousands of jobs. Reporter Vicky Stark chatted with the union's spokesperson.
This is Ford's biggest investment in South Africa since setting up shop here 97 years ago. Of the total, $686 million will be used for technology and upgrades at its Silverton plant in the capital, Pretoria. The company says this will support the production of the all-new Ranger pickup truck starting next year. The plant will also manufacture Volkswagen pickup trucks as part of the Ford VW strategic alliance. NUMSA's Hlubi Majola says this is positive news given the country's economic malaise even before COVID-19 lockdowns began.
You know, if you consider the economic situation that we're in as a country, we welcome investment. We welcome any initiative that's going to stimulate the economy and that's going to create real jobs.
Ford says it will hire an additional 1,200 team members, bringing its workforce in South Africa to 5,500. The investment will also create an estimated 10,000 new jobs across Ford's local supplier network. Hlubi Majola says she hopes these will be the kind of jobs that make a difference in workers' lives.
You know, when they talk about investment, they always talk about job creation. And that's always how they sell it to us, right? Mm-hmm. Is creating X number of jobs. We hear this a lot, but sometimes it doesn't actually materialize to the extent that they have said. So I'm looking at this investment. I know that they're talking about pumping money into the plant, and obviously that would be welcome. What would also be of real value would be the creation of quality jobs. What we don't want to see is a situation where this big announcement is being made, and yet at the end of the day, operations get moved from here to other places, or worse, trying to roll back on some of the current conditions that workers have already secured. What we want is that whatever is generated from this announcement, it must have a genuine impact in terms of increasing job creation, and in particular the creation of quality jobs.
NUMSA has also appealed to Ford to help bring about economic transformation by having diverse management and suppliers.
It has to be a project where black-owned business must be participating actively and must benefit from this process.
In a statement, Neil Hill, Managing Director of Ford Motor Company of Southern Africa, says Ford's investment in South Africa's manufacturing operations underscores the company's ongoing commitment to deliver ever better vehicles to its customers in South Africa and around the world, while providing opportunities for its own employees, new team members, and communities. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
A 61-year-old Christian missionary from the U.S. state of Pennsylvania was sentenced to 15 years in federal prison yesterday for sexually assaulting girls at a Kenyan orphanage he led. Gregory Dow and his family started the Dow Family Children's Home near Boito, Kenya, in 2008 and operated it for about a decade, according to the Associated Press. Some of the funding for the home came from churches and faith-based groups in the United States. In 2017, Kenyan authorities began investigating sexual abuse allegations against Dow. That is when he returned to the U.S. Among the four girls he was accused of sexually abusing in Kenya, U.S. prosecutors say two were only 11 years old. Acting U.S. Attorney Jennifer Williams says Dow's crimes are nearly incomprehensible in their depravity. Dow, who pleaded guilty to the four-count indictment last year, has expressed remorse in court and apologized for his crimes. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.